Eveen and Company with Eveen Ihoilewan on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning. My guest today was one of the judges on the last two seasons of the popular television show The Voice. He's been a member of a Meteor Award-winning band called The Blizzards, and in more recent years has launched two solo albums, the most recent of which is called Rage and Romance. He's playing at the Leopardstown Racecourse on August 8th and at Dundalk's Oriel Park on August 24th. Between gigging and training for triathlons, I'm delighted that we've managed to find some time to be in his company. And Brezzy, you're very welcome to studio.
Thank you very much.
Brezzy, our paths crossed in UCD about 10 years ago. You were UCD's official heartthrob, and I know you won't like me to say that, but I reckon you were the only rugby player that had a precious Takamine guitar in the house with the lads. Can you tell me, who gave you your first guitar?
In fairness, my parents bought it. My mum's a piano teacher. She was a violin teacher, and number one, the violin just wasn't that cool, and which ultimately now, ironically, is probably the coolest instrument you can play. We had a big grand piano at home, but you just couldn't carry that around with you. So I kind of always said to Mum, if you want me to get into music, you got to buy me a guitar.
And what age were you when you asked her that?
I was about 13 or 14.
Okay.
And I think that was during the grunge era, but I was in a heavy metal band. You kind of were in whatever your mates were into, and I really wasn't ever into metal, but I decided to learn it. So Mum got me a guitar, and it was like a BC Rich, which anyone knows a guitarist, it's one of those really horribly shaped kind of Kiss guitars. But I think with heavy metal, if you actually learn how to play heavy metal, the rest of the genres are pretty easy to play. So it was a good starting point. And then I moved on to Oasis, you know, Green Day, mm-hmm. all the really easy guitars. So I thought it was an absolute guitar god.
And how did you learn your first chords? Like, do you remember picking up that first guitar?
I figured everything out myself. I was a piano player. I'd been playing piano since I was 3 or 4. So in the same way I learned how to play piano, I sat there and I remember the first song was the Born a Monad or something that used to be played in the violin. I figured that out in the piano, and then Glen Rowe, and then all those tunes. And then I was like, this is actually pretty easy. And
that
then,
sounds adorable. So yeah. You're like, you know, 6 or 7 and you're playing the da-da-da-da.
Yeah, and my parents. I mean, the thing is, at the time, is anything was better than my mum teaching violin, because she was teaching it to people who didn't know how to play it. And any instrument in the world that you don't want to hear people learning is a violin. It's the worst instrument to hear played badly. And I used to be sitting in the upstairs in my room every day just going, I can't do this anymore. So me coming and playing Born a Monad was kind of a nice welcome break. For me, musically, I think it's great to figure out instruments. Mm-hmm. And if you can figure out one or two, you can pretty much get through them all.
And did you sing for your family then when you were playing the guitar?
No, I hated it. I sang in a choir. Like, the great thing is I was in a school choir, in a Christian Brothers school, and you'd assume you're just going in doing hymns and stuff. We weren't. We had an amazing conductor who kind of introduced us to the Beatles, and we started doing covers of the Beatles and Rolling Stones in a choir. And like, at this time, we just thought these were songs our conductor wrote, because we were so naive to music. So it was really good to get that introduction. And then I was also in a church choir.
What year were you in at this stage?
I started in third class. And like, the good thing about me in the choir is like, I did anything that got me off school. Like, that's like everybody did. I did choir, I did football, I did hurling, rugby. Well, I didn't do rugby, because rugby was like denounced in a Christian Brothers school because it was a Protestant English sport and we weren't allowed to play it. We're turning our back on our roots kind of thing. So yeah, I kind of played rugby on the sly, which is ultimately what I ended up doing professionally. So that was kind of one up on the Christian Brothers.
So you're doing choir to get out of school. It must have sounded lovely, because I think boys' choirs have a particularly, they're kind of ethereal almost when they're young.
Yeah, we were a good choir. Like, we sang for Mary Robinson. We won all the major choir like trophies. Was it the Sloga, I think it was called?
Yes.
Yeah, we won that. We were really good. And I learned a lot about music and singing. And the one thing I learned most about being in a choir, which I'm still addicted to now, is harmony. Some people struggle with harmony and they struggle with the idea of it and what it does. And it became second nature to me.
And you sang at Mass as well, Brezzy.
This is when, like, the hottest ticket in town was 12:30 Mass on a Sunday. You couldn't get into the church. And everybody was there.
Why was everyone there? Because of the choir?
No, just because it was back in the days when everybody went to Mass, like where it was the kind of you go into Mass or else kind of thing. And you go in on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock to prepare your set for Mass, and they'd pick the soloist that morning. So you wouldn't sleep Saturday night going, please don't pick me. Don't pick me. Because if they pick you, you have to walk in your little dress that they put on you, and you have to walk down the middle of the church, and you know, all your mates from school are looking at you going, you are dead tomorrow, because you're in your little kind of angelic robe, and you have to walk straight back down to the choir at the back. But No, I suppose it was my first introduction to singing in front of people.
So were you nervous at the thought of singing by yourself, or were you nervous at the thought of what the other lads were going to say to you afterwards?
Absolutely what the other lads were going to say to me afterwards. For a very quiet child, performing wasn't something I really bothered me, never has. It's something I've never got nervous about. Even now, big gigs or big events, they just don't really, I don't know, I don't mind crowds. I loved doing it. I loved singing. And I remember because we were such a fantastic choir, we were, I'd say at the time, one of the best boys choirs in the country, the choristers, and you had to audition to get in. And it was an incredible fundamental basis for learning about music because there's so much incorporation of music and singing. There's obviously melody, harmony, there is rhythm, everything.
Was it hassle doing something different, like being in the choir? Were you shy about it? Because you weren't always 6 foot.
I know, I was a really chubby little kid, but I definitely had no problem standing up for myself, to be honest.
And did you have to stand up for yourself?
Ah, yeah, of course you did. Everybody does. I mean, I think there's a difference between bullying and just being a kid. I mean, there's always going to be a certain amount of conflict as a child growing up that mightn't necessarily be described as bullying. People are going to slag you. It's just people still slag you as an adult, but you've got to the point where you're used to it and you're able to accept it. But, yeah, no, I stood up for myself on many occasions.
Tell me about being in Mullingar, Brazzy, because neither of your parents are from there. How did they meet up and then how did they end up coming to the Midlands?
My mum is Glaswegian and my dad is from Donegal. My mum used to go there every summer and just kind of started up a relationship. They got married, I think, pretty quickly. You know, from a holiday romance. So I think Dad would have been pretty charming back in the day.
I'm sure he still is as well. Your dad, he was in the army. Did that mean that he was away a lot?
Yeah, I'd say between the age of me being about 8 to about 18, he was probably gone most half of it, I'd say. And he was in Kuwait, Sarajevo, Israel. He'd been to so many different places with the United Nations and the army. But he brought us there a few times. He brought us to Israel and brought Mum and brought us to Sarajevo and stuff. So, you know, he got quite an eye-opening, but overall you got an opening to how lucky we are to live here and how much we take it for granted.
Why do you say that?
I mean, Israel, first and foremost. We lived in the border with Lebanon. You know, it was the first place I'd been where you really felt what tension was. The day we actually moved over, there had been no violence. There'd been no kind of hostility whatsoever for a couple of years. The day the Irish guys arrive over, a big war starts between Lebanon and Israel. And they start shelling each other. So we were moved into our bomb shelters.
So you arrived in a completely new country, completely new culture, and then bombs start hitting?
The funny thing they were saying, there's two types of bombs that Hezbollah had, the ones that go over our heads and the ones that can't get that far. So we were like in this no man's land where we weren't. I was like, that's really assuring. What if one of those shells don't quite make their target? And you'd feel the ground shake and stuff like that. And I don't want to make it sound like it was a war zone. It really wasn't.
But it still must have been petrifying.
It was. And I think the other side of it is, like, we actually weren't able to deal with the heat either. So we're like, this is like in the bomb shelter and all these like families kind of going, this is lovely. And I'm like, I'm going to die in here. The actual heat. I'd rather
that's
be hit by a shell, like, to be honest with you. But it was a huge eye-opener. And also, I think when you were there, you started learning an awful lot about the Jewish culture, and a culture we don't have a clue about.
And who else was there with you, Brizzy?
My whole family were there. Dad was there for a year and a half.
So he'd been there before you moved out?
Oh yeah, and he'd been there before, and he'd been over and back a few times at this stage. And I think because it was a bit of a longer time, he wanted to bring his family. Like, as difficult it was for us, for him to go when you were kids, it must be massively hard for him, obviously. And I remember we were made write letters to him every Sunday. We sit there writing, oh, I can't be writing letters to him. I want to watch Glen Rowe.
What used to you writing it?
Like, I'd say it's the most embarrassing stuff ever. I'd say he still has them, but like they were all in airmail and we'd send 5 of them a day or 5 of them every week because there was no emails. So like I actually cringe now thinking about it. But
and did you miss him when he was away?
I think you learn to live with it. There were certain places you go. You went to Kuwait, you're taken out of society into a society that really doesn't represent the Western world in any way. Mm-hmm. They lived out in a desert in a little house with 2 Fijian guys. So when he came back, I think he found it a little hard to actually socialise with us. And it took him a while to get back into it. Mum was incredible. Mum was hard. Like, she had to be. And I think all army wives had to be. Mum married Dad knowing that he was going to have to go away. So I'm also sure Dad probably wouldn't have married someone he didn't think could actually live with that. Like, loads of people have jobs in this country that, like, I have friends who've had to emigrate and leave their family at home because they have no jobs here. So there can always be worse. At least when you went abroad with the army, you know, you got well looked after.
And so you went to Israel with all your family when you were 12 or 13 for 8 months. Were you a different person when you came back from Israel?
I was a lot taller.
I remember
having these growing pains over there. Like, I didn't know what they were at the time. I thought I was dying. It was like one of those, something you see from one of those weird like mutant films. It was like it was growing in front of me. I was like, I couldn't figure out what was happening.
Because you are 6 foot two or three,
six foot six.
Are you?
I was 6 foot when I came back from Israel.
Excuse me, sorry. You were 13 and you were
14.
6 foot.
I was 14 when I came back. I was just under 6 foot.
So you left being, you said you were a chubby child in the boys' choir. And then you came back, probably tanned from being in the Israel.
I actually was. All you could see were my teeth. And I came back to 6 foot, all of a sudden, a different colour. So I said, who's this fella? And I also, really opens your mind going there, because you're quite impressionable at that age. And you ask questions. And I learned so much. Even from a political point of view, I realised that's something that interests me. Just knowing what had happened and the history of Israel and Lebanon and Palestine, and we all have our opinions on it, but we really haven't a clue. But I think I learned a lot by being there.
Do you think that's something that maybe all kids at that age should get to realise or get to experience, that other side of the world?
I liked it because I was interested in it, but I think you can't shove it down a kid's throat and say, listen, you should learn about this stuff. But I do think there's a happy medium, and the Kardashians is not the happy medium at 13 years of age mm-hmm. to believe that that's the way life is and that's the way life should be led. It shouldn't be. You know, it's not real.
It's not all about celebrity.
No, and that's the culture we're in, and it's a scary one.
Bring me back, though, to you coming home and then all of your classmates going, whoa, this guy is 6 foot. Mm. Who is he? Because you must have missed out on first year in secondary school, did you?
I missed a year and then went into first year, which is probably a good thing because, you know, I think I went to college at the right time then. I was like 18 going to college.
Was it hard to arrive back then into Irish life and settle back in Mullingar again after being away in Israel for almost a year?
No, I think that's when the whole sporting thing took off. Like, you couldn't stop me. Anything that was round and I could kick or hit, I wanted to do it. Like, and I mean, at the time we had an amazing club, Mullingar Rugby Club. Like, it was actually Joe Schmidt was coaching us at the time. He's the Leinster, he's now a new Irish coach.
Oh, God.
The Leinster winning coach. But he was like, everyone's going, oh, it's amazing we got him to Ireland. He started in Mullingar coaching our club.
That's pretty cool.
So I remember he was there and he had this amazing buzz around the club, and we all wanted to play rugby, and there'd be 400 kids out on Saturday morning playing rugby. So I got into it. I was playing Gaelic football at my school for my club, Mullingar Shamrocks. I was playing for the county, like under 16s. And it just really, it became such an obsession.
So it was all about sport then. Did you go back and join the choir afterwards?
No, I think that was the end of my choir days. I nearly joined it in secondary school, but I didn't, because it was all about, we're doing hymns. I was like, I've done that. Like, I want to move on to new material.
Well, surprisingly, Brezzy, your first choice this morning is Handel's Messiah. So what do you think of when you hear this?
We used to sing this on Christmas Eve at the Midnight Mass. You know the way, at Midnight Mass, everyone wants to just get out, go home, have a few drinks. But everybody in the church, when the priest blessed everybody, they all waited in their seats for us to sing this. It was quite a buzz, like, because Midnight Mass was at midnight. It was a beautiful, all the candles in the church. And it's one of those pieces that it took us months and months and months and months to get, you know, the vocals for it, because it's a tough, tough song. I think it's one of the most powerful pieces of music ever written.
Brezzy, can you still hit those high notes?
I can try. I've got goosebumps listening to it again.
Brezzy, you have this huge musical background, and I'll talk later about your rugby because you were capped for Ireland as a sports player and everything. But I want to ask you now about triathlons, because you've recently started doing triathlons. So can you explain for our listeners what that entails?
It's a real stupid thing that people have decided to take upon themselves. When I say
stupid,
I mean it's ultimately probably the most enjoyable thing I've ever really taken on as a challenge. Stupid is in terms of, it was off the cuff decision. Somebody dared me in a pub, said, I bet you can't do that. And it was like Marty McFly in Back to the Future, you know, nobody calls me chicken.
Did they know that when they dared you to do it?
I think so. There's a charity that I'm a director of, ambassador with, in Mullingar Lark, which is a charity my mum is director of. It's like a holistic cancer treatment centre in the Midlands. But this charity has been struggling, and I kind of said, how can I, rather than the obvious, let's do maybe a 5K run, or how can I bring the really practice what we preach. And someone said, well, if you sign up to do maybe a marathon. I said, I'm not doing a marathon. And they said, well, triathlon. I said, well, I can't swim. I actually cannot swim. I have a severe innate fear of water. I don't like water. I don't like being in it. Never mind the pool, open water scares the crap out of me. And I was like, well, I can't do triathlon because I can't swim. And they were like, well, what's the point in picking a challenge if you know you can run, you know you can cycle. So pick something you're not really that comfortable doing.
So at age 32, you decided to start swimming.
I got into the pool in January. I've been quite vocal about my mental health. I had tried so many avenues to try and control it and try and essentially beat it. And nothing really worked. And I felt the biggest thing missing from my life was a challenge. With music and with TV, you don't control them. You don't control whether people are going to receive you well or whether people are going to like what you do or people are going to perceive you like the way you want it to be. So, but with triathlons, you do control it. You control how hard you train. And from the rugby world and the Gaelic world, I missed that. So I decided maybe if I pick a challenge and something that's out of my comfort zone, it might actually focus my head. And in my mind and head, to do a swim in open water was my ultimate fear. And I said, if I can overcome that fear and use my mind to overcome that fear, and then if you can actually push that to your anxiety, the general anxiety disorder, which I have, you start realizing I do control my mind and I do have power in my mind. So I can start manipulating this other thing that kind of tries to control me every now and again. And that's why I did the swim.
That sounds like a very positive way to tackle it. And maybe I'll go back to talking about the anxiety in a little bit, Brezzy. But tell me then about the swim and the first open water swim that you managed to do. How did the swim part of the triathlon make you feel?
Well, I think the one thing with triathlons that everybody needs to be aware of is the people that do them are the most positive people I've ever met. And they're incredibly important to be around. They're so good for your soul, you know. And
why are they good for your soul?
They just are. Everything's doable. As much as I love the music industry, as much as I love entertainment industry and being involved with television, there isn't an element of bitchiness and politics that come with it. But with the triathlon side of things, there just isn't. It seems to be a non-toxic, positive kind of environment where people are just willing to help you. It's all positive and it's a great place to be. And then with the swim, it was the Lanesborough Triathlon, the Two Provinces Triathlon. It was into Loch Ree, into the Shannon, and that's just black. It's peat. There's a hydroelectric station right beside it, so all the peat was in the water. So you couldn't see an inch in front of your face.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel?
In the water, I got to about 400 metres at the swim, which is a long way in water.
How long is the swim?
It ended up being 850 metres in open water.
It's a fair old distance.
It is, and there's a current there as well because of the Shannon and stuff. So, but I was swimming out, and about halfway through it, I've never felt more relaxed in my life. I knew completely and utterly I'd overcome the fear. I was so comfortable in the water. There's lads kicking me in the head. There's lads trying to swim over me. And I was just completely at ease. And I started at the back because that's where you don't get hit or kicked. Yeah. And I ended up in the middle and got out of the water quite quickly. And I wasn't even out of breath. No one actually believed that I had this fear. But I think it just... I prepared myself. I had some amazing people in Mullingar, Doherty Duffy and Aninda. They run the tri shop in Mullingar and they brought me out into the open water in Loch Ooh, which is one of the most beautiful lakes in Ireland, crystal clear, and it really got my confidence up.
So tell me about that relief in the water then, that you felt so relaxed, more relaxed than you felt in years. Was it
you'd overcome it. You knew you were going to finish it.
Was that a breakthrough moment for you then?
It was huge. So that's why I think I did a pretty good time, is because when I got on the bike, I was like so full of adrenaline and so relieved. Like on the bike, I couldn't think of anything else except being in the water. And I don't remember anything in the water. I don't remember. The only thing I remember is that massive relief that now these things don't faze me at all. And that's, I don't want to oversell it. People all have fears. That's really my only fear. And it took a lot for me to build up to it. And I've absolutely, you can throw me into the sea, you can throw me anywhere now, once I have a wetsuit and armbands. And there's nothing like it.
Well done for overcoming that, Brezzy. Has it equipped you, do you think, then, for other aspects of your life that maybe you didn't feel in control of or you felt anxious about?
The real key to it is to figure out how to control your mind and how to control that if these panic attacks or these anxiety attacks start kind of coming up, how do you stop them?
Brezzy, I've known you for a fair while and I would never have thought of you as someone who would feel anxious. Like, when did that all start?
I was 15 years of age when I first started experiencing it. And I used to think I had asthma. That was my first thing. I've got.
And
some,
what would you experience?
I couldn't breathe. I'd be in a room trying to catch my breath, and I couldn't. You know, when you swallow your saliva, everyone does it. You know, mm-hmm. it's just a natural human instinct. It would get stuck, and then I'd start choking, and I couldn't breathe. And I was like, "What's wrong with me?" So.
And when would this happen? Like when you're 15, what does it happen? At anytime, school or at home?
Just anytime, and it wouldn't be brought on by any events. It would just happen, and I wonder what's happening to me. I was convinced it was asthma, so I went to all these.
And what
specialists.
Was the first time that it happened?
It built up. The first big one was when I was it was a couple of months before my junior cert, and it kept happening. Went to three different doctors. Nobody they said everything's fine. You're grand. Nobody could actually look me in the eye and say maybe this kid is suffering from anxiety. And anxiety is not stress. In the same way, a flu is not a cold. People say, oh, I have a flu. I say, if it's not, he knows. You don't have a flu. Anxiety consumes every part of your body. Stress is horrible. It's like, you know, that pit in your stomach. But anxiety just completely and utterly narrows everything.
What were you anxious about?
Nothing. That's the problem. You know, it doesn't pick its victims. There's also a really strong element of guilt with anxiety, because you look at yourself and you go, I have an amazing family. I've never really wanted for anything. I've been very lucky. I've been involved with sport. And then you look at somebody who's had a really tough childhood, or who has been, been abused, and you're going, well, they don't have it. And you feel guilty that you have it and they don't. But that's not how it works.
So on top of the anxiety itself, and then it's kind of feeding itself because you feel guilty as well.
You feel guilty, yeah. And it's a really horrible circle and cycle that it just picks up and picks up. And it came to a head where I broke my own arm. I literally held a chair at the side of my bed because I wanted to go to hospital, because I wanted the doctor to tell me what was wrong with me.
And what age were you when that happened?
16.
And you have to talk me through that.
Yeah, it'd be maybe a year of it. And it was the point where I wasn't able to socialise. I'd gone from this very sociable kind of kid who went out a lot, who played a lot of sport. I kept playing sport, but I dreaded going training or anything like that. Because
why were you dreading something that you were really good at?
Because I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I thought you go through this phase and I've been a hypochondriac. You go, like, I'm dying, something's wrong with me. And that's part of anxiety. You know, you think the worst. And I remember kind of going, I kept saying, well, I have to go to hospital. And she goes, Mum was like, well, there's nothing wrong with you. You've gone to the doctors. So I just thought the hospital was the place to go to. So I remember one day I just didn't want to go in, and I put a chair in the, wooden chair, and it kept hitting my arm until I felt the break. So that's kind of what a lot of children go through, undiagnosed. And that's why I came out and spoke about it, because that's how bad it got. And then I think then I started getting better in terms of I got a little bit more mature. I started figuring out what it was.
That's incredible that it was such a cry for help that you wanted to go to the hospital for someone to diagnose what was happening, but they still didn't diagnose it.
No, they wouldn't look me in the eye.
How did that make you feel then?
It mightn't sound like it, but I was a very strong teenager. So I was kind of like, right, if no one's going to do this, I'll help myself. And here's where the real issue is. Also, anxiety is not depression. Mm-hmm. And depression is, part of the same tree, but it's not the same thing. I was never down. I was frustrated, very, very frustrated, but I wasn't depressed.
You must have been lonely, though, because it sounds like you're really on your own with this, if no one else can understand it.
No, I know no one did. And I think my parents were aware of it. I think they were like, right, there's something wrong. And they did ask me, to be fair to them, and I hit it all the time.
In the hospital, did they ask you how you broke your arm?
Oh yeah, I obviously didn't tell them. I told them I fell with my hand behind my back and broke it. But I think even the doctor couldn't, that's not the type of injury you get, because it was my elbow. And it was just down from my elbow where it had broken. I was in a cast for 6 weeks. But I just thought that they'd tell me something, or they'd give me some information on what it was.
And did you regret doing it afterwards?
Of course. That's the thing about it is, and one of the major decisions that I had to make in the last year to come out and speak about this was because there's teenagers at the moment in this country who maybe have anxiety, severe anxiety or depression, who are taking their own lives. And I'm thinking back then, I was lucky that I had a really strong family, incredibly strong, amazing family and friends, to be fair. And I'm thinking, what if I didn't have that?
But you're obviously a very strong person yourself, if you were able to pull yourself through it.
I have a really unique experience of it. I understand it. And I understand that ultimately what really kept me together was how lucky I was and how my family and my upbringing and stuff helped. And sport, that sense of belonging, being in a team and saying, oh, we need you, or you're important to the team. So through college then. I went to college and things changed. It went. I think I started getting mature enough to understand what it was. I rationalised what it was. I said, this is anxiety. No one else will tell me this is what it is. I know this is what it is. And then I kind of lived through, went through college with it, and it definitely eased big time. Certain things would bring it up, silly things. Major events, major crises are when I kick into play and I'm really good. It's little silly things that kick me up. Somebody could think you said something about them that you didn't, and then you get really paranoid about it, and then that can kind of kick it off. Whereas something massive could happen, and that's when I'm really good. When someone needs something, they'll come to me and go, right, how can we deal with this?
Can I ask, was it school then? Was it secondary school that was making you more anxious?
No. With me, that's the real insane thing about anxiety. There is just no set way of how it works. And that's where the frustration comes in with it. Mm-hmm. People can't figure out where it comes from. But you see with me, because of having that ability to challenge myself, I was able to overcome it. Mm-hmm. And I went through college. But when I got into, 26, 27, moved to London, I could really feel it coming again. And I could feel it slowly just coming and coming hard.
How does it manifest itself then? Like when you got, say, your first panic attack?
Panic attacks are, people are afraid to say they have them. I suppose the most severe one I ever had was I was on The Voice, and it was Sunday evening. And live TV just doesn't make me nervous. A lot of people get nervous and just doesn't really bother me. And these type of events don't bother me. They don't get me stressed. But I remember being in the dressing room getting a knock on the door by our producer at about 20 past six. And it was like somebody grabbed me by the throat, started choking me. I started vomiting. I fell on the ground. I couldn't breathe. I ripped my shirt. I couldn't stand up. I had no energy in my legs. I couldn't physically get myself up. And all I could think was, there's no way I can go on television. It takes 3-4 days to get over a panic attack. I had 5 minutes.
Were you on your own?
Yeah, I'm completely on my own. And I kind of, the door knocked again. And I just remember just putting water in my face, ringing the stylist, saying, you have to come out here, my shirt's ripped. She's like, how did you rip your shirt? Couldn't tell her, obviously, that I had a panic attack.
Why did you have that panic attack?
I don't know. That's how they work. I have no idea. Up to that point, I felt fantastic. I was really relaxed and just my throat just basically narrowed. And
you must have been still in shock after it then. Like, how were you able to perform at all on the live TV show?
I left that show that night and said, that's it. That is the last time I'm going to let this happen. This particular one could have had huge, it could have caused so much more than it did. I could have not been able to actually make it onto the chair to even do the show, mm-hmm. which would have asked a lot of questions. So then I said to myself, I have to stop hiding this.
But what was the build up to that? Because you said when you moved to London in 26, 27, you could feel it coming on.
I think London has that ability to do that to people. I loved it. I loved London, but it's a completely and utterly, it's every survival of the fittest, every man for himself. That's how they run there. You have your core friends who are incredible, but they've all got their own lives. And I felt to myself that there seemed to be this severe lack of humanity there or something.
So the isolation of living in the city of London, which is profound. I mean, I've lived in mm-hmm. London as well, and I didn't like it either. Is that really what's prompted you then to move back to Dublin?
I think, I actually fell out of love with Dublin, to be honest. I didn't like living here. I think during the Celtic Tiger, it wasn't a pretty place. It was everything that I loved about Ireland, I loved about the people, was gone. It was just being sacrificed for economics, really. And even regardless of the recession, it just wasn't pretty. You were in college at me. You'd seen going to clubs, watching students spend 300 quid in a night out. And you're kind of going, this is something seriously wrong here. And you were basically judged on how much money you had. That's how people judged your moral and your personality. And I just thought that didn't suit Ireland. And then when the recession hit, we had the side effect of it all, which was severe cynicism. For someone who had suffered from anxiety, being in these toxic environments is really not good. But then in the last, say, year or two, I fell totally back in love with Dublin again, because we started going back to what really made us a country that everyone loves. Our culture, our creativity, our personalities. No one ever liked Ireland because we were rich.
Tell me then, I mean, we've gone through the panic attacks and that really severe one that you had a couple of months back, but everything seems to have moved on in the last 6 months.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's where it's come in. And where I have to be very careful when I speak about this, This is how I dealt with it. This isn't actually the cure. This is how I dealt with it. But before I figured this one out, I took 7 or 8 different routes to figure out which was the one that worked for me. But the message I tried to point across is there is something that works. It is dealable with. That's the big message. In the last 6 months, I think a big help is me talking about it in public. That's been a huge weight off my shoulders. I don't have to hide it anymore. I spoke about it to my family years ago, but to people like yourself who said, I couldn't imagine you being like that. I can't for a million years thought you'd be like that. I am. And coming out in public was a huge thing for me. And then I said, right, for me, what's been missing in the last 10 years? And that's been a physical challenge. That's where the triathlons came in. I said, pick something that is you overcoming. You know, it's something you basically overpowering your mind and telling them who's boss. And that's what I did.
Brezzy, I want to go to a song now that does bring you back to your teenage years. And it's The Beach Boys, God Only Knows. Mm-hmm. Why do you love this song?
I was obsessed with The Beach Boys. I think it's, once again, it's the harmony thing. I was always into harmony. And that song, the lyric was what sold that to me. And that lyric was written by a bank clerk that Brian Wilson went into one day, just probably to lodge his billions from his royalties. And the bank clerk gave him a piece of paper and said, I've this lyric, I think you should read it. And he was going back in his car and he went, wow. Like that lyric, God Only Knows What I'd Be Without You. For me, it's probably the greatest pop song ever written.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you.
That was The Beach Boys with God Only Knows. Brezzy, you were saying before we played The Beach Boys about the harmonies and the melody that goes into that song. You have a great interest in all of these things because songwriting is your full-time work, really.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to listen to music anymore without kind of deconstructing it. So it's probably a demon in itself when you start going into the production world and figuring out how some tracks are made. And then obviously when you come back to something like The Beach Boys, even that you realise that that's 12 musicians in a room playing together actually at the same time, which is not done anymore. And even from working in studio environments and songwriting environments, you realise how processed music has become and how, unfortunately, most of the top five that we're hearing now, there's no musicians actually on it, only a singer. It kind of opens your eyes a little bit and scares you as well.
Oh, how does it work? Because you're signed as a songwriter in England. So does someone say to you, I want a song about love, it's poppy and I want it for Jessie J? Is that how it works?
No, I can't do love songs. I'm just not good at them. I can't bring myself to doing it. Like, sincerely, another breakup song is not required in the Billboard charts. I just think it's time to move on, guys, and, you know, give the world another subject matter. And
people
then on one
love
side,
that though, Brezzy.
They do, but that's the problem. There's so much more to life than breaking up with girls and guys. You know, there is so much more to you can sing about. In the same way, an awful lot of rappers sing about how much money they have. People don't need to hear that.
Can I ask though, have you been in love? Is that why you can't write love songs or why you prefer not
to
write love
songs? No, I just think
songs?
If you're going to write a love song, you have to be clever about it. And you can't just blatantly just come out with a love song. And that
would it be easier if you were in love?
I'd say so. I'd say it definitely it would help. But then again, what I love is going about an artist and saying, so what's in your mind? What can we sing about? What's actually genuinely impacting you at the moment? And how do we sing about it with cleverly? And when I say cleverly, how do we come up with a title that isn't obviously that obvious? Mm-hmm. But a lot of them just sit there on their iPhones. Just look at their iPhones, just kind of seeing who tweeted them. And
a lot of artists?
You get artists and you kind of, and then you know at that point, right, they don't care. That they're here because they want to get their back patted when they release their songs with their friends. And then you get the artists who are just so into it. And you go, now these are people who care.
So there's an integrity to it for you in the songwriting business.
There is. I mean, I'm a pop writer. I'm a pop fan. That's where my heart is. But you still have to have an element of honesty in what you're writing. It could be the simplest thing in the world. It could be really, really simple. But there has to be some meaning behind it.
And you started a new songwriting business based in Dublin.
I think what we have in Dublin, and this is respectfully, we have incredible songwriters. But what we need is more forward-thinking producers. From my side of things, what happens is you often write a song and then you spend 2 days trying to produce it. And by the end of that 2 days, you're sick of it. So in terms of a songwriting shop, I want to have a room with three people, four people, doesn't matter, writing the songs, passing on just the idea, which could just be a piano, onto the producers, who then make it into something that's appealing and can be listened to in terms of radio sense.
It's a very entrepreneurial idea.
But it's been done in the UK a lot. Cinemania, who did all the Spice Girls stuff, and you got Metrophonic, who did all the Cher stuff and the earlier big hit pop stuff. That's how they worked. But if you have a core of writers who actually are trying to keep an element of integrity, and more than anything, I want to develop. I want you find somebody who's maybe a bit, who's got a really incredible raw talent, but still is not quite fully versed with studio and fully versed with songwriting and structures and stuff like that, where we can come in and facilitate them rather than write for them.
So is that the future for Brezzy then? Are you going to leave your own solo career and focus on the songwriting industry?
I think performing on stage is too much fun to just walk away from.
Are you going to do The Voice then next year?
I'm at the point where I have genuinely not heard anything yet. For me, it's never about money. It's never about time commitment. It's about standards. And if we can maintain the standards and get better singers and stronger singers, and I'd love to be in a position where I could work with them more, but people don't understand that. We have other jobs, mm-hmm. We do have day jobs. So we can't sit in a studio from 9 in the morning to 9 at night
working with them.
And there is some, I'm doing the Cycle Against Suicide album. I'm producing it in early August. I have Ryan Sheridan, The Coronas, Gavin James, Codaline, all these incredible artists on it actually wrote songs for this specific point of this album. With doing this artist, I've incorporated some of the people I've worked with on The Voice, like Pat Burns on it, Shannon Murphy, who I thought was an incredible singer, who was on it this year. Mm-hmm. She's singing on the album with me. So I do believe in these people. If I really believe they're talented, I will work with them again and I will bring them in again. But they need to understand it won't be handed to them.
What really shines through for me, Brezzy, when you're talking is that it's all about the music. But when I knew you 10 years ago in college, I thought you were going to go and do a master's in economics and stick with the rugby. And music was a total sidetrack. So tell me, what made you make that decision to leave the sport? Because, you have the stature for it. You had the scholarship in UCD for it. You were signed with Leinster.
Simply, I wasn't passionate enough about it. I love rugby. I'm actually the biggest Leinster fan. And that's one thing, for example, Rowan O'Gara got actually backlash this year about having one or two bad performances. And I realised how fickle the sporting world can be and how the actual spectator can be very fickle, and not realise that guy won a Grand Slam for us with a drop goal. And I kind of said to myself, do I want to be in that position where I can't walk when I'm 40 and just forgotten about? Because I had gone through so many injuries at this point. I'd gone through ridiculous injuries for somebody of my age.
What age is that?
23. In terms of rugby, I mean, there is serious injuries in terms of spinal injuries. I didn't have any of those, but I had injuries that stopped me performing at the level I needed to perform at. Such I tore my quad muscle off my bone. Nothing comes close to the pain of a ruptured muscle. And it essentially stopped me running. I couldn't sprint. I felt useless. And also with my background in what I'd gone through my teenage years, I didn't want that to come back. And because I was starting to feel that when I wasn't able to play.
You didn't want to feel anxious being a rugby player?
Yeah, where I couldn't play. I loved playing. When I was fully fit and I was on it, I absolutely adored it. And I had potential. I had a professional contract. I was at that point, I was playing very good rugby, but those injuries started kicking in. And psychologically, I started getting very down about them. And I remember one particular incident, I was playing for UCD, actually down in Gary Owen. And the following Friday, I was picked for my first on the squad for the European Cup, which was a huge, it was my first European Cup at Leinster. And I was totally chuffed about it. And I went down to play on Saturday in Gary Owen. And all I can remember is being in Limerick Regional Hospital that day, projectile vomiting into a screen because I thought my eye was lost. I lost my eye. One of my own players stood in my face by mistake, obviously, but I ended up basically destroying my eye. I couldn't see out of it. I had muscle damage to it. And I was lying in bed in my UCD jersey, covered in blood. The jersey was ripped. I couldn't see. I was vomiting. And I went, that's it. Done. And I got the train back to Dublin on the Monday. Opened the train looking like the Elephant Man. Sitting on the train with an ice pack on my face. With a pair of clothes that somebody gave to me. I walked straight into Leinster and I walked into the coach and said, I'm retiring.
Tell me about ringing your agent to tell you then that you were giving up rugby and you were going to become a rock star.
I didn't say that to him because he probably would have hung up with me. But my rugby agent is James Adams. He's a South African guy, and I really liked him. He believed in me from the start. We had a great relationship, and it wasn't a money thing for him, because he was like, you know, your first couple of contracts, I won't take commission. I want to. So that's a great start. But when I rang him to say I was retiring, he just goes, do you mind me asking what you're going to do? And I said, well, I'm actually really into music. I started a band. And instead of going, yeah, good luck, you know, he went, oh, actually, have any demos? I went, yeah, yeah, we just did one there at the weekend. He said, send it to me. I share an office with Marcus Russell, who's Oasis manager. So just by chance, I sent it to him on the Wednesday, and Marcus Russell was in Ireland the Friday. He flew over to Ireland to meet us.
What an amazing opportunity.
He just said there was two songs and he went, yeah, I'm into this. And he took us under his wing.
So you left rugby because you weren't passionate enough about it. You're so passionate about music and you're pursuing that. But what do you do for fun?
I don't have a lot of free time, to be honest with you. But
do you go out for, you know, beers and
Dublin? Oh yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, I like going home. I really love going home.
Home to Mullingar?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I just feel very relaxed there, and I, you know, my mates genuinely don't care of anything. I don't have to speak about anything. I feel, and it's okay and all, but when you go out, sometimes you end up just answering questions all the time, and it just gets a bit tiring. And I think with my mates, they know that, and they'll just sit there and they'll just basically pull the piss out of me for 2 hours in the pub. And I actually love that. And I do see training and triathlons as a hobby for me. It does help my professional life, which is really, really lucky. I don't have some crazy leisure life that kind of counteracts what I do professionally. So they go hand in hand. But I do. I love going away. I love getting out of Ireland. And
is it good to be anonymous?
Yeah. I'm quite a shy person. I'm quite a private person, which is quite, you know, ironic considering what I came up and told people about. But I felt that was something that I needed to talk about, mm-hmm. because as private as it was massively beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Brezzy, at age 13, your life kind of changed because you were in Israel. At age 23, your life took another turn because you quit rugby. You're going to be 33 next year. What do you see changing? What's the future for you now?
33 is a horrible age.
Why?
I don't know. It's just, I don't know. I think with me, it's I'm a million miles away from what I essentially want to achieve in terms of music anyway. I mean, there's so many. I'm still not 100% sure what I want for music. Is it a production songwriting team that I work with? Is it performing? I really just don't know yet.
What about you personally, though?
I mean, personally, like everybody, I mean, I'm like anybody else. Like, I want to have kids. I adore children. Like, my nephew, I have a nephew at the moment, like that. Like, I'll spend 3-4 hours just doing nothing with him. And I just think it's definitely something. I think I'd love to be a father. You know, like everybody else. The thing is, people also assume because you do something on television or music that you don't want to have a... You are just like everybody else. You want to have a family. You want to have someone you love. You want to live in a nice house. You want to have kids. You want to have a dog that doesn't shit in your kitchen. So what more does a man need?
Well, with half the women, I imagine, in the country swooning over hearing you say that you just want to be a dad. We'll end on a last piece of music, and it's a bit of a surprise, I think.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I think everyone's so used to hearing my song, the songs that I'd probably go into produce in the studio. I think sometimes I just strip it back and get your acoustic guitar, because essentially that's where it all starts. That's where every song starts. And I find it probably this song actually really relaxing song to play for me. I just play it to myself a lot. I don't play it for many other people, but I'll play it for you.
Thanks a million, Brezzy. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to me this morning. You're at Leopardstown Racecourse on August 8th and Oriel Park in Dundalk on August 24th. You can tune in again next Sunday at 10 a.m. Gajishin, Slán Thamel, agus Shulliv, Brezzy.
Thank you.
Evening and Company on RTE Radio 1. Podcast the show at rte.ie/radio player.